What if I told you that there's a point in every physician's career where you can actually stop paying for disability insurance, and that most docs have no idea when that point arrives? Keep listening as we dive in. Welcome to the Money Meets Medicine podcast, where we talk all about the personal finance topics you wish you had learned in medical school. I'm your host, Justin Harvey, and here is your co-host, who got rid of his disability insurance before he even got it, Dr. Jimmy Turner.
Yes, it turns out that if you get denied disability insurance, even if you have a guaranteed standard issue policy when you're in training, you can't get disability insurance. So as my Instagram profile now says, I'm permanently uninsurable. Fortunately, you don't have to be. You don't have to let somebody talk you into doing bad things with your disability insurance decisions like I did when I was a fourth year med student. But yeah, so I find this just to be a funny question that we're going to talk about on the show today, because it's about when to consider like getting rid of some of your disability insurance products, your insurance products, other insurance products you might have as a physician. And naturally, I don't have disability insurance because I can't get it because I'm so uninsurable at this point. And so I'm answering a question that I don't have to actually partake in my own life. I do, I guess, have to answer that question from a life insurance perspective, but from a disability side, I don't have to answer it. And yet I get this question not infrequently. And so I thought it was one that we've never talked about on the show before. And so we're going to take two tacks on this, Justin. We're going to talk about the kind of insurance products that physicians need and why, and just thinking through that. So the first half is a reset on which insurance products may be worth your time. And the second half, we'll kind of flip the side of the question and say, okay, great. Now that we have all those insurance products that we know we need as a physician, what should we do about it? And specifically, disability insurance and life insurance, because I find that to be a really common question, because those products, particularly disability insurance, aren't cheap, depending on how much coverage you have. For some people, it's a pretty big number that they pay every single year to make sure that they would remain intact should they become disabled. And while I think it's obviously a product that every doctor needs, when and if should you get rid of it? That's the question. Before we dive in, don't forget, don't be a me and get denied disability insurance by getting bad advice from an insurance agent that's not doing the right thing for you. You can actually get a quote and know what all of your options are, not just some of them, by going to moneymeetsmedicine.com/disability. We'll look into guaranteed standard issue offers that exist, which is the kind that 50% of doctors need. It's the kind that I should have applied for but didn't know about because the insurance agent didn't tell me. So don't let that be you. We'll look into all your options, make sure that you have everything on the table in terms of the things you can choose from and which is best for you. Go to moneymeetsmedicine.com/disability and click get a quote. All right, Justin, so let's dive in. We're going to talk about full physician insurance stack here. And we've already talked about disability insurance, but this is my take. I've actually never asked you, I don't think directly, but I've always viewed this as like the number one financial task for physicians, because like we can talk about investing and paying off debt and getting a financial planner and all those other questions that we cover on the show and student loans. And if you lose your income, you can't do literally any of those things. And you have to sell your house and just all of the terribleness that would come with becoming disabled as a higher income earning physician who worked really hard to create that income. And so for me, this has always been step one, like don't pass go. Like I would tell you to get disability insurance, even if you had credit card debt, and then pay off your credit card debt as like step number 1B, because without your income, none of the rest of it matters, including the ability to pay off the credit card debt, right? So that said, I come from a situation where I got screwed and maybe I'm a little salty about it. Maybe my perspective is a little warped. So I'm giving you a chance for feedback here. What are your
thoughts? Like a true insurance salesman, Jimmy.
That's right.
I totally agree. I would say, you know, anything you have that's of value, insure it that you can. Just had a three-year-old fall onto the ceiling above my head. So insure anything you possibly can. And insurance is only one of a handful of risk management tools. So broader context, like entities, conscientious practice of medicine, not living a high-risk lifestyle and not being an idiot out there in the world, treating people nicely. These are all ways to reduce the risk to your assets. Insurance is a very contractually defined, like you pay a fixed cost and you receive a fixed amount of protection for that cost. And insurance is an awesome tool. So for disability insurance, when you come out of training and you're 32 years old and you can make, use round numbers, $500,000 and you can do that for 30 years, we're talking $15 million of future income on the line. I guarantee you there's not a lot of 33-year-old still negative net worth doctors that are running around out there that have a different thing that they also own that's worth $15 million. So in almost every case, the most valuable thing that you have is your ability to earn a meaningful income. And so own occupation, disability insurance from a great carrier is a no-brainer. And I'd say like in every case, do it. And I would actually say like maintain it longer than when you need it. And we can get to that in part two, but that's definitely a cornerstone protection. And yes, do it before you're out of credit card debt. Yes, basically just do it before you're out of training. Get on the graded premium if you need to. Pay that like just a few dollars a month just to get something locked in, GSI if possible. And then, yeah, you can move on down the list, down the hierarchy of other things that you're going to need.
Yeah, and that's a great point to make because, and this is something that is unique to us. So it is surprising to me how few residents know that you can actually make disability insurance pretty affordable, even on a resident budget. And you mentioned one of the ways we do a ton of graded premiums for clients. And the reason why is because that is one fantastic way to get your insurability locked in residency and to make it less affordable. It's going to slowly creep up and, you know, eventually having a level policy would make more sense. And guess what? Someday when it creeps up and that makes sense, you'll be an attending and you just convert to a level premium at that point, which you're able and allowed to do. But that's a great way to get coverage and keep it affordable. Another way is to reduce the amount of benefit that you get. So how much would you get paid if you got disabled, right? So you actually technically for years have been able to be overinsured as a resident with the amount of money they give you that you'd get post-tax compared to what you currently have plus your group policy. And so you can actually take slightly less sometimes, depends on the situation. And it allows you to lower what your monthly cost for disability insurance would be too. So oftentimes that's the number one reason people wait is like, oh, I'm just going to wait until the end because it's super expensive. It's like, actually it doesn't have to be. Like just because an insurance agent is showing you like a $250 quote on disability insurance doesn't mean that that's what it actually has to cost. It can actually cost less than that. So just want to call that out because I find that's one reason why people wait. Even then they find out that it wasn't actually as bad as they thought it would be. Something else that's physician specific, malpractice insurance. I'm just going to call this out very quickly and just mention it because this is one that's sneaky that ends up having contract implications for when you decide that you want to leave a job that you sign. And so you need to be aware of what your malpractice premiums cost in your specialty in your state. Sometimes they cost a lot more than you think. Like if you're an OBGYN in Florida, I bet that number may be higher than you realize it when you're in residency and you get out to become an attending and don't realize that maybe your employer is paying for that. Where this kicks you in the teeth is tail coverage. And so if you're listening to this, you happen to be in residency, you haven't signed a contract yet, just get really clear on who pays for your tail coverage. In other words, covers all those things that happened while you were there after you leave. Is it you? Is it your employer? Is it paid for by the kind of policy that your employer has? You need to know the answer to that question because pretty much every physician is required to have malpractice insurance and no one's going to take you as a doc if you don't have coverage for things that you've done in the past. That's a liability for them.
Yeah, this is one of those things when I'm looking at contracts for people, which I'm not a lawyer and none of what follows is legal advice, but understanding the implications for who's paying for the med mal, who picks up the tail if there is tail, how does it change depending on your tenure? In some cases, if I'm here for 3 or more years, the employer will pick up the tail, but if I leave after 6 months, then I have to pay the tail. That can be, as you pointed out, Jimmy, like that's a six-figure number for OBs in certain states, and it's a high five-figure number for many of my clients in anesthesia and pain, especially the procedural specialties. Negotiating around that, it's one of those things that's a soft cost. It's not like I need a $50,000 signing bonus where that's a hard cost in year zero to the employer. This is like, fine, you know, depending on what happens in the future, it's an easier thing in some cases for your counterparty to agree to it because it's not costing them dollars today. So your future self will thank you if you understand what are the terms of the med mal and make sure you can optimize for the future.
Yeah, and another physician-specific one that may not seem physician-specific, but in my experience, I think it's something that every doctor should have because it's so cheap and just kind of covers a variety of things as umbrella insurance. And it's just a ridiculously inexpensive product that is another layer of protection should you go over certain other policies like your home insurance or your auto insurance. And, you know, you have a teen driver, like Grace just turned 15. We're going to be getting a learner's permit. I'm acutely aware that my liability has just increased as a physician because of my daughter. And so having umbrella insurance, as silly as it sounds and as inexpensive as a product as it is, I think actually makes a lot of sense for most doctors. But I've never actually asked your opinion on that, Justin. What are your thoughts on umbrella insurance?
Umbrella is one of those most dollars of protection for fewest dollars of premium policies out there. So it does cover the more sort of outlier types of scenarios, but it's the kind of thing, man, if you rear end a Maserati on the way home from a call shift or you nod off rolling up to the red light, like you're going to, or have some other sort of catastrophic event or your dog bites a child and there's a $4 million lawsuit. You know, these kinds of like weird things that you're not going to be covered in your baseline protections. This is in many states, a handful of hundreds per million per year. So like $500 for a million per year, or if you need 2 or 3 or 5, a rule of thumb is umbrella approximating your net worth up until you get past three or four, and then it's kind of, you're probably needing more risk management tools at that point beyond just insurance. But having a few million of umbrella, I think, is a great deal, and it doesn't cost you much. And every now and then, it really saves your bacon.
Yeah. Another one that is obviously common that everyone on the show is going to want to learn about is life insurance. And you and I are both big proponents of term life insurance for a variety of reasons, but this one's tricky. And I don't think people realize this, but the question, when should I get life insurance? Well, when you have someone that's dependent upon your income, that could be kids. It could be someone else in your life you love that's dependent upon your income. And if you died, you wanted them to be able to be taken care of. The tricky part here is that sometimes people will say, well, I know I need life insurance, so I'm going to go ahead and get term life insurance. What they don't realize is that there's a full underwriting process in life insurance. Like, there's no GSI, there's no guaranteed term life insurance, although that's actually changing at some institutions, interestingly. But term life insurance is going to go through an underwriting process. They may get laps. They're definitely going to get chart reviews. They're definitely going to find medical history, and that's going to go into the insurance system world. And so when you then go apply for disability insurance, you may have things on your chart that are now discoverable that wouldn't have necessarily been discovered in a disability insurance process. And so the order of operations here that I always recommend to people is to get disability insurance first, which doesn't have as extensive of an underwriting process as life insurance, and then go get life insurance. So for me, it's like, don't get disability insurance until you're in residency, then get it as soon as you can. We can make it affordable, and then get life insurance after your disability insurance process is complete, so that you don't bring in extra things into your disability process that might make your life harder when making that application.
This is one of those areas where anybody can go to one of the websites where you just get your own term life policy from whatever company, and it's very easy and great, and it's a tech forward experience and cool. For a lot of people, that might work. But I will say, I always recommend working with a human, especially when it comes to life insurance. Having a broker who understands the process and who can shepherd you through the underwriting, also ask good questions during the fact finding before anything goes to underwriting, because God forbid you send something out to the insurance companies with a non-starter red flag in your file. Often, if you suss that out in advance, you can apply to certain companies or tailor your application to get you the most of what you're looking for the least amount of cost. And if you just throw it out there into some internet search engine that's going to crunch some numbers and spit you out a verdict, you know, perhaps that's true for non-medically underwritten policies under a certain threshold. But if you want like a seven-figure number or more, then working with somebody who knows what they're doing, it's really essential.
I completely agree. And this is actually one of the ways that we have a less than a 1% denial rate at Money Meets Medicine for disability insurance is we call it pre-screening, right? So we ask them all the questions. And then if there's some concerns, because sometimes people end up finding Money Meets Medicine, and unfortunately they are 6 or 12 months out from becoming an attending. And so they don't have the GSI anymore. They have a health history. It makes it harder to insure them. And so we can go to the five companies and be like, so what if I had a client that potentially had these things? What would your thoughts about that be? And then we're like, okay, well, that one's not going to insure them. It's a hard no. This one's going to have some modifications, some limitations on how they're going to insure this person. This one says that they think it's probably okay. And so at that point, the GSI is no longer available. So you have to apply fully underwritten because you're 12 months out from training. It goes away 60 days for most people after training. So that's why you don't wait. But we pre-screen them. And then we know, okay, which of the five companies, based on these conversations, has the best chance to get this person insured is because of going through that process. And to your point, with everything being AI nowadays and automated and all that stuff, what people do is they put all their information into a little engine on some very reputable, well-known websites, and they just push them through the process because, hey, from their standpoint, you're just a number, right? Like, if you get through, they make money. If you don't, they're just gonna move on to the next one, and you never even had to interact with the person. And maybe if you did, it was for 15 minutes. Definitely not long enough to really understand your history and your needs and which company you would be best served by based on, you know, your current situation. And so I completely agree that white gloved service when it comes to insurance is really important because of that pre-screening process. And a lot of places don't do it that way. A lot of places will just push your application through and move on to the next person if it doesn't work.
If you like this podcast episode, you're going to love the other shows over at the Doctor Podcast Network. For instance, Luxury Cruising. You know that moment? Sipping champagne, watching the sunset from your private balcony suite. Yeah, that's the magic of luxury cruising. Dr. Crystal Seditis takes you there on Luxury Cruising, Explore the World in Style. From the most opulent ships to insider secrets on upgrades, she's your guide to traveling first class at sea. If you're dreaming of your next escape, this is the podcast for you. Search Luxury Cruising and subscribe. your suite awaits.
There are very few people I trust
in life, less and less.
But when it comes to the, you see under the hoods of enough, you know, this is true in any business. Financial services is just another business, and there are good people, conscientious practitioners, and there are less so also out there. And good insurance professionals are worth their weight in gold.
Yep, completely agree. And so then you've got the other stuff that obviously is obvious. So you need auto insurance, home insurance, that sort of thing. Maybe one special comment on health insurance, which is that as a physician, HSAs are often available for you. And so from a health insurance standpoint, maybe it's not just a conversation about, hey, I need health insurance. Maybe it's, should I use an HSA or not? And more, this is actually interesting, Justin. I've had conversations with people asking me about HSAs and residency. And fascinating conversation, because I'm like, the reason that HSAs make sense to me is that I am at a stage in my life where I can cash flow any medical expenses that come up. So I can actually use the HSA and let it grow tax-free and keep the receipts, and then I can recoup them later and all that fun stuff that makes an HSA triple tax-free and amazing. But when I was in residency, the idea of footing a $5,000 or $7,000 or $8,000 or $10,000 medical bill, if something happened, I did not have that money when I was in residency. And so I would not have wanted an HSA. Like, if I could go back with the financial literacy that I have now, when Jimmy Turner was in residency and had access to an HSA, I still wouldn't do it unless the other plan wasn't any different. There wasn't a big cost differential. It wasn't going to save me a bunch of money. And then whatever, it's going to cost me an arm and a leg no matter what. But if you have another plan that's low cost and you're in training and you're not married to someone who has a high income, for me, like, I don't know, HSAs, you need to be able to afford to cash flow them in order for them to make sense if you have something come up.
Especially because the tax benefits closely approximate your 403b contribution. If you're maxing out a 403b at 24.5, and maybe you're also a super saver and you're doing your back, or at this point, just a Roth IRA contribution, 7K, and you're on the PGY scale. If you have any money left after that, like, go on a vacation.
Yeah, enjoy your life. Yeah, no, I completely agree. So let's round this out to part number two, right? When should we, as physicians, consider getting rid of our insurance products? And maybe specifically we'll talk about term life insurance and disability insurance, because what I've seen happen in the space, and I remember talking to a good friend of mine, Larry Keller. He is actually one of the good people in the insurance space. So always give him props. You don't work with us and you work with Larry, I'm never going to get mad about it. But that said, I remember having a conversation with Larry and just him running into a lot of people who found the personal finance space for physicians, and they got latched onto this idea that as soon as they got to financial independence, which has some funny math around it, right? Like, when you get to quote unquote FI and you're 45, are you really at financial independence, given that 90% of your money is stuffed away in a 401k or an HSA or things that you'd have to take a 10% penalty on in order to withdraw? Like, that math doesn't really math the same exact way, because you don't have access to all of your money. And he just made a comment to me about that, and I thought it was really interesting that, yeah, you're right. When you have these insurance products and you're super young, even if you've quote unquote gotten to the mathematical idea of what financial independence is, so classically taught in this space is 25 times your annual spending, that seems really young to get rid of an insurance product that, you know, if you're not going to practice medicine anymore, obviously you don't need it. But if you're still practicing medicine, I don't know, there's a territory in there where that becomes a really awkward conversation. Like, hey, buddy, like, this isn't just about math. This isn't actually a mathematical thing. Like, you're 45. So you probably should not be getting rid of your disability insurance at that age, even if you have $4 million in savings.
The way I process this question is, you go from maintaining something because you need it to maintaining something because it provides a form of leverage for your finances and for your estate. So leverage is when you put out a dollar and get $2 of value in return. And when it comes to life insurance, for example, you know, if you've got $4 million of term life and you also build up a $5 million portfolio, and if you died tomorrow, your family would have enough to put your kids through college and have your spouse live a comfortable life, then you're going to be fine to pay that $340 a month to maintain this term coverage because you've got millions of dollars. So at that point, the cost is immaterial. It literally just doesn't impact your finances at all. And the potential benefit, even though it's just sort of icing on the cake territory, it's true that your surviving family won't necessarily need this. But if I was left with, like, I could leave my wife $3 million or leave her $7 million, you know, which would I take? And obviously you do a probabilistic weighting based on, okay, it's not actually $4 million. It's $4 million times the value, or times the probability that I'm going to die before the policy expires. But for me and for the clients that I advise, I say that if you don't need the money, this is the icing on the cake territory. Maybe it's starting a foundation in your name. Maybe it's leaving money for your grandkids to go to college. Maybe it's, you know, whatever that's going to bankroll. Money is flexibility. Money is options. Money is influence. And the marginal cost of me leaving my surviving family with more options, more influence, more flexibility, the marginal cost is de minimis. Why would I not do that?
Yeah, I agree. The older I get, the more that I realize the sound advice here is probably just to hang on to your insurance products. And part of the reason why, so you can do the math from like the financial independence standpoint. Do I have 25 times my annual spending? Another way to think through this is to consider like how much of your costs are paid for every month. Like if you told me your house is paid off, you have no auto loan debt, you have no forms of debt in your life, and your average monthly expenses are $5,000 and you have $25,000 worth of disability coverage. Like maybe in that scenario and you've got $4 million in the bank, like you are crushing things from a mathematical savings standpoint, but also from a, you don't have a lot of fixed cost standpoint. And so if you died, your spouse would probably be fine, like from a life insurance side. And if you got disabled, like maybe your spouse makes $5,000 a month and you don't even technically need your income based on your current living. There are scenarios where I think it does make sense because you're so leveraged in terms of having absolutely no debt, or you have such a large number that paying $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 a year for disability insurance maybe doesn't make sense. That's a $4,000 trip you could take. But I think that situation is much less common than people would like it to be. And so the older I get, the more that I realize that hanging on to it makes sense. And I agree with the term life insurance. Like I still pay for term life insurance and I probably will continue to. And I got talked to do a term 80 policy by a Northwestern agent. So, I mean, I get to keep that thing for a real long time. Without getting into the details of why that's not a great thing. I think I even have a whole insurance rider in my policy. I refuse to look at it at this point just because I got talked into bad financial stuff by that company. But and now that I have Graves' disease and a whole like 5,000 other things on my medical chart, I couldn't get life insurance if I wanted to at this point. So I'm stuck with what I got. You got to go with the girl you brought. It is what it is thing.
I just haven't met the 48-year-old or the 52-year-old who's like, you know, I got 13 years left on this policy, but I can't deal with the once a year, cutting the check for it. It's one more thing. Like that person, maybe they're out there, but when this person who now has $3, $4, $5, $6 million, they're like, yeah, it's an additional warm, fuzzy blanket that I just wrap around me and it's that extra layer of protection. And I don't even know how much it costs and I don't care. That's right. Typically what
because
I see.
Because you're doing so
I'm
well.
Like, I totally get that. Exactly. Yeah. And
provides that financial security and the ability to lay your head on the pillow at night and not worry about it. And that's my friend worth something. All right. Well, as we round out this show, hopefully you learned a little bit about some insurance stuff that maybe you didn't know about and also have now considered, when would I get rid of it? Should I get rid of it? Should I keep it for the duration? And you're going to have to make that decision for you because personal finance is personal. I definitely encourage you having that conversation with a financial advisor, a financial planner, if you're making that decision and or your insurance agent about what your possibilities and options are. But yeah, I think this is a show we haven't in the 270 something episodes of Money Meets Medicine we've ever discussed. So I thought it was a good one to bring up. As we head out, don't forget, speaking of insurance, go to moneymeetsmedicine.com/disability to make sure you get disability insurance, particularly for those of you that are in training, and make sure that you look into your GSI or guaranteed standard issue policy, which is the kind that 50% of you listening to this need. Don't let someone talk to you into applying to a fully underwritten policy, getting denied like I did, like I shared at the beginning of the show, when you have access to a GSI. It's a huge mistake, one that I regret to this day. Don't let that be you. All right, everybody. We will see you next week. Cheers.
Justin Harvey is a certified financial planner at APM Wealth, where he helps anesthesiologists and pain medicine physicians. Dr. Jimmy Turner is a practicing academic anesthesiologist at Wake Forest in North Carolina. He's also a licensed insurance agent. However, either Justin or Jimmy are your financial planner, investment advisor, or insurance agent. This show is expressly for general education and entertainment purposes only. Nothing should be considered financial advice. All views expressed are solely the views of the guests on the show and do not represent the views or opinions of their employer.